So, Horace, with a Simcar, we have discussed rather extensively the challenges facing the auto world, from disinterested teenagers to a growing number of transport options, often options enabled by smartphone apps. So, facing this market and thinking ahead 4 or 5 years, how should an entrant join the party? Is this a Motorola iTunes deal? Should Apple apply their user experience talents to the i3, for example, and sell it through BMW dealers? Should they go it alone? How should Titan approach the market? What do you think, Horace?
Yeah, so let's step back a minute and just rephrase this in a different way. Let me try to put some context in this. So computing came into the world sometime in the 60s, essentially, right? I mean, as you can say, it was much earlier, but it became a force of disruptive potential early enough in the mid-20th century. And over those decades in the 20th century, it just became more ubiquitous, mostly because it got smaller, mostly because small size became cheaper. And so some people attribute this with a proxy of Moore's Law. Moore's Law is a function, a calculation of the density of components on a semiconductor chip. But it's really a function. As a result, it describes the ability to produce transistors, the ability to produce, therefore, these building blocks of computing, which are enabled by software, which follows the availability of hardware. And so we went through this exponential growth in the availability of computing, which meant the curious side effect of this is we could just say, well, that's delightful to have very powerful and very many computers, but that did not change the world. The ability of having high speed and ubiquitous computation in and of itself overwhelmed our need for computation. It overwhelmed our need to literally compute, as in calculate, as in add numbers and keep track of things. What computers changed into, because there were so many and they were so powerful, is that they began to rub up against different industries. And that's what this show is about. This show is about it bumping up against yet another industry. Now, let's look at who they touched after conquering the bookkeeping function of early computers. By the way, the very earliest computers were used in code breaking, so that required a high degree of computation. Then the later computers were used in creating essentially tabular records or computing artillery tables. Then they were used by businesses. So there's a military was pushing for high speed computing, and then businesses began firstly by keeping track of their books, their accounting. That's how IBM was defined, the business machines in the B and the M in IBM. And these were business machines. And what did businesses needed to do is they needed to keep track of things. Mostly numbers were used in accounts. Then as we move forward, they became small and they ended up on people's desks. Now, most people's desks didn't need accounting. They needed other things. And that was the Microsoft and PC era where people said, well, we can do things so-called productivity. We can do things with computers that allow people to be more productive in their day-to-day tasks, which means writing things and communicating inside of an office, things that would require a mail room, things that required a secretary pool, things that required binders and mimeograph machines and carbon copies and typists. All those things were essentially taken over by computers, and that's what established the strength of Microsoft, is the Office suite enabled people to do away with what was known as middle management. Collectors and disseminators of intermediary information between those who produce and those who who plan. That's what middle management was. It was just swept aside. And that was one of the things that nobody planned on doing with computers. They just happened to show up, and that's what they were hired to do. So then when computers got better and fast or more ubiquitous, then they became more portable. And so they started bumping up against other industries, things like entertainment industry. Now, I'm sure no one in Hollywood invited them in, nor did the inventors of the computer actually say, hey, we're going after movies or television or music. It just happened to be there and hire me. I'm just a poor computer.
Roadkill, of course.
Yeah, but that's the funny thing about the predictability or unpredictability. At the core of this discussion is whether somebody who shows up at your front door knocking with their hat in their hand saying, hey, I'm here looking for a job, and you decide to hire them to tend the garden or what have you, and then they end up,
eating the estate. Yeah.
Yeah, being your boss.
Right.
So this is the pattern. So you see computers coming into something called entertainment. Now, even before entertainment, they came into something called telecommunications, although mostly on the on the side of this central office. And we used to have something called a central office, which was literally a big building where a bunch of switches were located. These are noteworthy buildings because they had typically no windows, even though they were fairly big buildings. You can still see these in some cityscapes.
Sure, the CPU of the organization, really.
Yeah, so these were acting essentially as smart switches or better switches that were more. First, those switches were mechanical, then they were electromechanical, then they became digital, and the digital meant that they could finally, be connected up with the computer. And that's where in the 1980s and 90s, computers from AT&T. And by the way, AT&T through its Bell Labs division was heavily investing in computing power because they wanted to make their network better. They didn't care about, MP3s. But you can see how telecom, as a result of inviting the computer in, ended up becoming subservient to the computer. The computer and those who offered the services on top and the software on top actually came to dominate telecom. And it took a lot longer than we might have expected, even though they were in the back office or central office in the 1980s. They didn't actually start to dictate the business model until this decade. And so it took a while for telecom to become an appendage of the computing industry. And of course, entertainment is another one, although again, there, music went one way, but video and film haven't converted yet, or haven't become completely subsumed into computing. And so now we finally ask, after seeing productivity, aka management and the office world change, after seeing the telecommunications world change, after seeing the entertainment world change, these are just the ones on the top of my head. I think if you were to look deep and far, you would find many industries that essentially have become appendages, or I don't even know the right word to describe this, have become subservient to computing. And now we're asking this about
cars.
I would say more the transportation sector.
Yep.
And there are several other sectors. Sometimes I refer to these as giant, vast oceans that have been unexplored, or no one has gone on them with a boat. And by the way, by the time we're done, the ocean is paved over. It's not just conquered. It's literally completely subsumed. And so the vast oceans are. In the sort of, again, we have to qualify this, is that there are computers in these spaces, but they're not actually, the computers have so far sustained the business. They haven't changed it in any material way in terms of how it's designed to operate. So transportation, healthcare, energy, education, and government, these are the ones I always give. Although on critical path, we were challenged on the question of government, but it's still the agent of change of technology, the software and computing world. The promise is, and the question is actually, I should say, whether it can fundamentally change. And we use the word disruption, but I would say it's more than that. It's far more profound in the sense that disruption describes a turnover in competitors. But it actually, that's a symptom itself of a much more profound change that occurs, where I think in the era of computing, it traumatizes it to such an extent that it's not just the incumbents that are replaced, but rather the way of doing things and the institutions that are built around it. So when you're dealing at this level infrastructure, you have to think much more than, oh, so-and-so was replaced by another entrant who happened to be smaller than they were. That's not telling the full story. There's a bigger thing that's happening. I don't know if we have a word for it. We have to borrow the word disruption to describe it. So that's really what this is all about. And in my, when you peel back the layers and you say, well, computers in cars, great, that means I can get my MP3s to play, or great, that means I can have a more rational user experience within the dashboard. That might be, in fact, and we talked about this, I think, before, is how Audi proposes or has stated that they have, that their cars have 100 million lines of code. Did I mention this before?
Yes, we've discussed it. Yes.
Yeah. So that, to me, that's either a shocking revelation or sort of a shocking in the sense of being so not believable. Or if it is true, then it's something seriously wrong with the car if it needs that much code. So that's where we are. And I think we want to dedicate this show to the so-called Project Titan, which is the logic of Apple's entry. And you know, when we started the show, because I came from an Apple-centered worldview, we put the Apple as kind of one of the jokes around what would happen with an Apple car. But now it's becoming more and more
real. Before we dive into that, though, because your Audi comment, I think, is prescient. And I want to just quote Ford's CEO this week, who said, "I describe our strategy as having one foot in today and one foot in tomorrow." He said, "We're becoming a mobility company and an auto company." So to me, as a software guy, that 100 million lines of code probably represents trying to fuse the new with the old and the tax or the cost of doing that. And so is the fact that we're at that point, maybe that just represents the timing that it is time for the Titan. It is time for the new product.
So many things are so because these are not single vectors of change.
Right.
When the computers come in, they come in. And the computer enabled the lithium ion industry, although it was initially the foothold market for lithium ion was the camcorder from Sony. Computers have taken that industry to a new level. As a result, the ubiquity of lithium ion has compelled actually Tesla and now many others to consider that as the battery of choice for mobility. So that's one vector of change is the availability of higher density batteries, and that coupled with the mobility of phones and smartphones and the ubiquity of those components has meant that the car can be redesigned and reimagined, as the word that's used, as a different thing than it is. And this is how it comes in. It comes in almost imperceptibly, as if nothing's really should worry you. And then at the same time, we have apps which enabled ride sharing and which enabled the infrastructure to be shared as opposed to be owned, which is what Uber is bringing to the table. So you have these multiple vectors of attack, and the car guys are sort of sitting there, not as the deer in the headlights, but the deer facing three sets of headlights coming from three different directions. And so they're paralyzed without knowing what to do. And I don't want to dismiss them at all. It could end up actually still sustaining them. And that's one of the discussions we're having is to what extent are the car companies going to embrace some of these things and use them to get stronger rather than ignore them and get weaker.
Oh, sure. Look what happened to the telcos, Apple enters with AT&T, and their business is bigger than ever.
Yeah, and AT&T and many of the other guys also resisted actually the smartphone, and were using it to egg on the other phone makers like the Nokia and Motorola's, and then to fight these incumbents. And I was shocked, and I actually commented to a friend of mine. I don't watch TV, or at least not programming. I should say I have a TV. I turn it on once in a while, but I don't watch what's called programming, which means the whatever is being pushed through the broadcast networks. And I was watching, and because of that, by the way, I don't see commercials. So if someone tells me about an Apple commercials, I have to go find it on YouTube because I'm not likely to see it. And so I see one to five commercials a year. That's because I choose to. But the thing that when you become desensitized, I suppose, when you watch commercials all day long, and you may just see things. So for someone who's not watching commercials, is dazzling, bewildering, and completely it just causes a huge amount of discord or unsettling. It's very unsettling. But we're watching a bit of football, and I was watching a football game, and I saw an AT&T commercial, and the AT&T commercial was actually an iPhone commercial because they were telling people how they could get an iPhone. And I was surprised because last I checked, which was years ago, all the U.S. operators were trying to get everybody to buy an Android phone. So if you walked into a shop, you would see only Android phones with salespeople wearing Samsung T-shirts trying to sell you a Samsung phone.
Yes, of course.
Through, you know, the spiff method of being paid off to do so. And I thought to myself, well, of course, you know, if someone's bribing you, you're going to sell them that phone. And I so it's like, I'm watching this and saying, well, hold on, there's something odd here going on. Besides, in between watching, by the way, the Apple commercial popped up in between watching a lot of car commercials. Apparently everybody still wants to buy cars, or sell them anyway.
Well, at least in the States, this is a record year. Yeah. 18 million cars.
Yeah. So it was just ad after ad for cars. Maybe this is because of football, but anyway,
it's all related,
it's all related. So the Apple and just the this question about how do we get onto this? How do we get onto AT&T? Oh yeah, so AT&T used to be treating Apple, even though they were the launch partner, they were treating them with a very kind of
I'm sure they were a stepchild. Mm-hmm.
They wanted to balance things. You know, they didn't want Apple to get too strong. And Verizon launched Android, or at least Droid as the brand. They'll say that it was they who launched Android and so on. But they were doing it because they felt that they wanted to offset or balance the power. But they were definitely in the driver's seat. Nowadays, people are saying, you know, I care more about the phone than I do about the carrier. Now, what this has to do with cars is that at some point in time, you might actually care about the experience in the car more than you care about the vehicle itself.
The company that assembled the pieces, yeah.
Or you know, saying, so whether that becomes a service or not, we'll have to see. There's a lot of other constraints on the business in terms of longevity of the product, in terms of regulation, and in terms of taxation. One thing that came up recently was the fact that, and I hadn't thought of this, but a great thinker called Anton Wallman, who is someone I follow on Twitter now, and he writes about the car industry, he pointed out, or rather in the comment stream about Tesla, he pointed out that there are no the gas tax partially funds
roads.
the roads in the United States, and this is true I think in many other countries, and so you pay for the infrastructure through the road through the gas tax, which actually is one of the most fair taxes you can imagine. The more you drive, the more you consume gas. In fact, the heavier your vehicle, the more likely it consumes, inefficiently consumes gas, and therefore the more you should pay a tax because of the wear and tear. In fact, in the U.S., it goes so far as the tax on diesel is higher than the tax on gasoline, because diesel vehicles, although more efficient, tend to actually be heavier, and they should be taxed more heavily. So your basic truck or your semi-truck, tractor trailer is going to pay a lot more for road maintenance than a lightweight Prius would. And yet, the Tesla, which is not a light car at all, it's quite a heavy car, pays zero gas tax.
Right.
So it doesn't participate in the maintenance of the roads. Now, obviously, once we get beyond a certain, in fact, it's worse than that. The government pays you to buy one. So the way I phrased it on Twitter was like, well, someone who's quite poor and can't afford a Tesla is paying the Tesla owner to destroy the roads that they depend on more. So it's a regressive tax. Those who can the electric vehicle taxation, and of course it's temporary. Of course it's not going to last. But you can, and it's done for a different set of reasons, which might be, you know, better for society in the long run. But nonetheless, at some point, this is going to come up because someone will say, look, we have diminishing revenues for road maintenance while these battery vehicles are eating up the roads. And so you know how things work, and people will change the law, and instead of paying EV drivers, they'll tax EV drivers.
Right.
And then what? You know, how will you do it? Because then that's a question of how you can't tax the gasoline. And I've had the Twitter conversation about this. So how do you tax the usage of an EV vehicle? And people were suggesting all kinds of clever things like, well, you have to submit information about how many miles you've driven. Okay, sounds good in theory. How do you do it in practice? Do you go to an inspection station?
There's a lot of people who have insurance trackers on their car already, and so
the technology is there. Come on, this is a trivial problem.
Yes.
But as far as the infrastructure to collect this information and to provide money, and have every municipality in the world and every state in the world and every government in the world have a consistent system of collecting information on how much you've driven.
Right.
With gasoline, you don't need that.
No.
The point is that you're going to an information infrastructure when you're going to electric, or you tax kilowatt hours or what have you, as far as trying to pay for roads through your electricity bill. Will that happen, or will we have to have compliance through actual monitoring of the amount of miles or kilometers traveled? And this is why, again, this is why when you start to ask the question, what is the impact of a technology on an infrastructure, sometimes it goes so far that people just simply say, we've got to change the way we do things at a fundamental level. And that's one example, just one example of, and not even a computing one, it's simply the fact of using a new energy source that will affect the way the infrastructure is paid for.
Sure. So what about this notion that the Ford CEO mentioned, you know, one organization having a foot in today and one in tomorrow, becoming a mobility company. So seeing the information, you know, the Capgemini guy we spoke with a little while ago mentioned that he thought that most of the industry sees what's coming, but, you know, can they pull this off? And then think about Project Titan and where that enters.
So, yeah, so it's so far using the strictest definition of disruption, it would appear that I don't see either Tesla or Apple doing things in such a different way that would cause or Faraday forward, or maybe we don't know anything about them, so we can't say anything about them yet. But the only one that might be different would be Uber, because they actually want to do away with ownership of the car. So there's a lot of questions about whether these entrants are really disruptive. But the weird thing about the computing vectors is how they have an illusion effect, or they have a bait and switch effect, or they have a turning of the tables effect. I don't know which analogy to use, because what they tend to do is they come visibly into a market, not necessarily at the low end, not necessarily at, you know, at addressing consumers with less money, but rather they just come in and subtly and almost imperceptibly change the rules of the game to eventually their advantage. And it just happens so gradually that it feels like the boiling of the frog or the camel. What is the other one? There's a camel in the tent. All of this kind of like gradual change, when it's in your face, you can't ignore it. You can't ignore the fact that there's a camel coming into your tent. And that's the thing that you need a extrasensory perception. You need a perception of this, a sensitivity to it that is beyond what anyone teaches today. And that's what we struggle with. And you need to have this kind of chess playing mentality. It's like, well, this move follows this other move, follows this other move. And then playing with an opponent that can only see one move ahead is not very challenging, but nor very, very entertaining. So I would try to ask when the next move comes, let's say when the Titan product launches, what will be the new moves that Apple will be able to make, and what will be the moves of the incumbents or other players at the multi-sided game that is being played? What will be their moves to counter that? And a winning strategy, or one where Apple, let's say, becomes a significant agent of change, will require probably 4 or 5 moves ahead, which is very difficult to forecast. And I don't know if I said this. We should link to some of the stories that ran. I was last week in front of UBS, and the subject of Apple Car came up. And I simply said that it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of how many Apple cars will be built, and whether the commitment from Apple will be on a scale of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions. That's really the crucial question as far as Titan's concerned. And whenever you go up one order of magnitude, you have to reassess all aspects of the strategy, meaning distribution, support, regulatory, pricing, manufacturing, questions of design, and product marketing in terms of portfolio. Just about everything changes as you go from one order of magnitude to the other. And here's another wrinkle. What if Apple starts in the thousands, and that move one is in the thousands, so everybody says, oh, there's nothing to see, move along. Then move two is hundreds of thousands, and people start to say, wait a minute, what's going on? And the third move is in the millions, and then people suddenly say, okay, it's game over.
Exactly.
And that's what they did in the phone space. They started out saying, oh, we just want to have 1% of the phone market within a year. And everybody said, firstly, no, you can't do that. You're crazy. And secondly, once they did it, they said, well, you're exclusive, you're U.S. only, you're not going to make it anywhere
beyond. Too high priced, right? All these
too high things. Priced. Yeah. You don't have an ecosystem. You're a luxury product for
closed
a few.
Closed software.
Yeah. Exactly. Or and so
garden, right?
you get that foothold, and you're making money hand over fist, and people still dismiss you, and then you don't go to the next level. And it's still now, 8 years into it, everybody says, okay, it's over. You know, that's how they win. They win simply by everybody finding thousands of reasons why they can't win. And so I suspect same thing. I mean, we're seeing the same phenomenon, by the way, with the watch. The watch is the same phenomenon. It just comes in, you know, they sell 7 million. Everybody says 7 million doesn't move the needle. Well, it just happens to be more than any other watchmaker in the world. It's more than any other fitness band in the world, but still, it's not significant.
It's irrelevant, Horace. Yes.
It's irrelevant. So it just keeps marching. And then next year's 20 million. Then next year's after that's 50 million. Then next year after that, it's 100 million. And then people start to say, yeah, but it's a flash in the pan, or they're going to get commoditized or somewhere, and so on and so on and so on. And so this story just repeats itself. And I suspect the car business will repeat again. I short circuit it. I say, first, they're going to enter. Now, that means they're going to enter at a certain number. We don't know what the initial number is going to be. And again, my target right now is that I think for them to get involved at all is they're going to want to do a 1 million unit business within, I'm going to take a guess here, within 3 years of launch. But that's already a very aggressive target because Tesla is at 50,000.
Nowhere near that unit, no.
50,000. They formed as a company in 2003, so they're now into their 13th year as a business, and they're at 50,000 units.
And announcing new cars that are a year
and a half. They're on their second model. They're launching their third model, which is priced even higher.
80,000.
Rather than going into the lower price bands, they're moving up market. And so this new model is, I just saw the pricing today, between 80 and 150,000 fully loaded. I remember when houses were 150,000.
Depends do you remember where you live. That? Yeah, of course I do, but depends where you live, Horace. Yes.
Yeah. So that's where Tesla is, but then after 15 years they're not going to be at 1 million units. They're not even going to be at 500,000 units, and yet that's where you need to be in the top 10. And I think top 10 cars only, if you look at top 10 altogether in terms of all vehicles produced as a group, I think to be in the top 10, you need to be around 2.5 million units to be up there with the big automakers. So would Apple enter into a business if they were not going to be, as again, the phrase they use, have a meaningful contribution?
Right.
How would you be meaningfully contributing to this market if you were going to be making less than the top 15 companies in the world? I think they to be meaningful in my book, and this is completely my book, it would be imply at least 1 million units a year, not 50,000. And that's how I see meaningfulness. And that's where I would target them at 3 years in, 1 million units, perhaps 10 years in, and this has become completely nebulous and out there, at 10 years in, which is not there yet with the iPhone, but let's assume, maybe 10 is too long. Let's be more ambitious. Let's say the same time that the iPhone has been around, which has been 8 years. If we say the car at 8 years old, by the way, because cars last longer, it's very probable that the first cars will still be on the road when the eighth year comes around. So bear that in mind. There's hardly any iPhone 1s in the hands of people today. So imagine what that's going to be like. But let's still be aggressive. Let's start with the year 8 in our mind. So what would their production volumes be in 8 years for the car? And well, that's what I would say. I would hope that they're at 2 to 3 million units in 8 years, which doesn't sound like much, and the growth rate would be fairly modest if they were to achieve that. They're at over 100 million phones a year. Hell, way more than that, actually, over 250 million
right.
phones a year. And over 300 million, a third of a trillion, sorry, a third of a billion iOS devices a year, a third of a billion. So that's where they got with iOS in 8 years. With the car, just being super aggressive, we're looking at 2 to 3 million in the same amount of time. So two orders of magnitude below where they are with iOS. Yet still, you know, the pricing of the product will be 2 to 3 orders of magnitude higher. So we might be looking at a business that is still substantial in terms of sales.
But I think to your point, it does follow the pattern if you think back to the first iPod. And we used iPod recently in our most recent ASIM car. But if you think about the first iPod, for some reason, 300,000 units sticks in my head. I don't know if that's the first quarter or the first 6 months or
iPad or iPod.
iPod.
iPod did very, very little volume in the beginning.
It's tiny.
It took about 2001 till 2000. When it peaked, I'd say it was probably around 2005 or 6. 2006, I would say. So yeah, it took about 6 years to reach maximum, but that was much lower volumes
than iPhone
ever
exactly,
got.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that one seems a bit plausible and familiar. But that sort of volume after 3 years, a million units, as we talked about before, one would think we'd start seeing supply chain ripples from that.
Yeah, so that's where I think. So that's the other thing we should look out for, signal wise, is that I don't think that the reveal on the car will happen at the moment of production or shipping start. It'll have to happen before, because with the car business, you know, these things will, the test meals will be out there.
Oh yeah, too many players. Yeah.
And too many players in the value chain. So I think the way the car industry does it is the way Apple is going to have to do it, although maybe not quite as early as they do it. So, you know, doing a reveal, although cars, they have car shows, or, you know, they have these...
Oh, sure. Frankfurt, Detroit, New York.
Yeah, that's how the industry does it. I think Apple's going to have their own event, but still, I would imagine they're going to do a reveal.
And they're usually a year ahead of time, if not 18 months. They'll say, oh, this is what's new at Frankfurt, late next year, right?
So I would say if they think they can ship a car in 2019, I would think that they need to go with a reveal in 2018, even possibly 2017, because also that might signal to the market. Remember also when they do the very first iPad and the very first watch, they were quite a bit ahead of the launch date. They were as much as 9 months with the watch, maybe a bit less. I think they launched in they revealed in September. They launched in April,
right?
And the original iPhone was revealed in January, launched in June. That was a 6 month lead, and so for purpose of getting it approved and so on, and they know that the leaks are going to happen, so they don't want that to. So I still think that we're looking at possibly, I'd say, minimum 1 year before the product is for sale.
Will it be sold? So 2018, 2019, you know, we back to my original question on distribution, will it be sold, Horace? And if so, how?
Yeah, that's
be leased or will it be?
That's a great question. I don't think I can answer that because I think that my working hypothesis is that it's going to be an object that people will want to own, because Apple is very keen on having that relationship with the customer where they are giving them an object and that the customer values the brand through an object. And this is design thinking, going back to Jobs, but going back to every designer there, and obviously Johnny Ive, Mark Newson, that they see value in the object. And the service is something that makes the object more valuable and preserves the relationship.
Well, that's why I ask about buy versus something else, because if you see the latest iPhone, clearly Apple has gotten into the monthly payment game, right? The carriers had that for a long time. Now they're in that game, and that would, to me, lend itself to the car game, because, of course, cars are all about, well, get your, you know, it's $3.99 a month or whatever it is, and here's your check, here's your bonus when you buy the thing, and all these other schemes. And clearly Apple has other vectors where they are charging $2 for storage and so much for music and other things. And so it would seem to me an annuity model would be appealing to them.
It may seem, and maybe they'll finance the cars in a way that allows people to think of it as a service. But and that is how customers currently look at car ownership. They
for the most part, right?
Yeah, they think of it as a monthly payment, and they think of it as a relationship with the dealer. In fact, most of the ads, although they're for a product, they always say visit your local dealer,
of course,
who's offering seasonal
specials,
promotions,
Thanksgiving,
and you know,
end
special
of the month, whatever. Yellow,
they're
yellow
all
balloon,
sales
right.
incentives, mm-hmm. And I think they'll want to go away from that because they'll want to go direct to the customer, and they'll want to say, although AT&T again acts as a sort of an iPhone dealer. There's still something, you know, we're not seeing this. I think rather than trying to overlay a lot of the complexities that exist today because of the way the system is built, I think we need to try to think of how they might do it from a clean sheet of paper. And Tesla has shown that you can do away with the dealers. And I think Apple will do something along those lines, although they might, because of the scale. See, Tesla can do what they do because they're such a small scale. But for Apple to do what they have to do at a million-unit scale, they're going to have to rethink a lot of that because distribution is an issue at that scale. You do need a service component that involves a lot of manpower. It involves a lot of real estate. And I always ask, why not have dealers? Because the dealer is there working for you, 2,000 people selling your stuff. It can't be a bad thing. But at the same time, there's downsides to it as well, right?
Well, so it's like Best Buy or like AT&T or Verizon, as you say. You walk in there and that's what it is. It's the deal, you know. And pick this week's promotion. You know, somebody's paying and here you go. And that's why, to me, that customer experience decision has to be fundamental to this because either they're going to ride the current model or they're going to go it alone in a very different way, and that's an interesting bet, as you say, at those volumes. And they don't really have the retail footprint to do it with cars right now. They certainly have the footprint to...
But they didn't have the retail footprint to do the watch. That's the other thing, is that the watch is still sold through the same type of retail setup. And I remember when the watch launched, I was asking myself, are they going to have to redesign the buying experience because watches are sold differently, their wearables are sold differently, and I don't think the current model is particularly I don't think the current model is actually the right one, because look at it this way: everything's under glass. You have to make as a customer either an appointment or you can just walk in, but still it's awkward. It's not sold the same way you'd buy a phone or a computer. It has to be dealt with in this awkward manner, and I just don't think it's optimal. I mean, it'll sell fine, 10 million units, 20 million units, but at some point they'll have to decide, how do we deal with this through all the points of sale that Apple goes through? How do we manage the sales process for this new category of product? And I'm sure that's what's occupying their minds. It has been for some time. And maybe it's just a matter of waiting. Again, we're so impatient. We want to short circuit everything. We want to go from zero to infinity. But in this case, it's like, no, let's do one step and see what happens, collect data, then do the second step. And that's probably how they're going to approach the car as well. So it's hard for us. So I think the only thing we can say is their ambition level has to be sufficiently high to make a meaningful impact, and that means over a million units. I assume that they want to ramp as quickly as possible, so that implies 3 years. I'd assume also that maybe they'll start out of the gate in the tens of thousands. Now, whether that's 10 or 50, I can't guess. But I think if they're in that ballpark, then they'll have to do a dealership, or rather an Apple car store model, similar to the way Tesla does it, which they have to have storefronts which exhibit the vehicle so you can sit inside it. And Apple can't do that with their current stores. So they may have to launch a whole new set of stores.
I'm going to differ with you on that one. I think, let's again fast forward ahead.
Flagship maybe,
Not even that. I think if we're really going to think different here, so 3 years from now, the 3 year from now iPhone or other devices that may exist, you know, there are some car companies that are playing around with, you know, more virtual reality purchasing and these sorts of things. So one would think that part of Apple's strategy is to leverage all the devices they have out there, right? I mean, That would make sense. And so maybe the buying experience becomes part of that device. You know, we have maybe a more immersive experience in terms of both the iPhone and then the interior or the user experience of the car. I remember driving the i3 a couple of years ago and just thinking how disappointed I was in the interior, given it was pretty much a patched together traditional car interior versus what they might have done. And I suspect that they have the opportunity to change that discovery experience with all the devices they have and perhaps do away with the need for a big showroom, or maybe not. Maybe it's just the industry is such that we still have to go sit in the thing and
someone once said that cars are sold, the people are attracted to the exterior, but they're sold on the interior. So this the idea is that you need that ability to sit and play with it before you feel comfortable with any purchase.
You look so better maybe, in the leather, Horace, yes.
Yeah, maybe what all they need is like a mock interior of the car that they could maybe have that half a car or something like that. But I still don't think they're not going to go with a half-ass measure. It's going to have to be interesting. That this whole question of how to sell it is crucial, absolutely crucial, and that's where again, devices and computers, Apple worked out that they needed their own stores. They could not just live with shelf space. A lot of products today are sold on the basis of shelf space, and Apple said no to shelf space. Now, they introduce a watch, which is a completely different category. Then they're going to introduce a car, which is a completely different category. And they may not be compatible with the store, which is the box, the small box inside of either a premium real estate location or a mall, which is in the U.S. So you have this question mark over, all right, you've introduced a great new technological leap forward, but how do you sell it? How do you get people to agree to buy it? And that is, you know, that's a crucial question, and it's a tough one. I have to say that I don't know. I mean, even after the watch launched, I still don't know what they're going to do about the watch. Is it merchandising or the way you place it into a store? And this is a great question. We got to have a lot of feedback on this and see what people think. It's not enough to just say, great, build them and they will come.
So what about the financial part of it, Horace? You know, is Apple going to, like they're doing with their phones, are they going to keep ownership and let us rent them? Or fast-forwarding 4 or 5 years, but is that what they're going to end up doing? And maybe that changes the whole service equation because you pay them and they just take care of it. You need another one, it appears, they take it away, kind of like Tesla in that respect.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that the ownership structure, the product's life, usable life questions related, especially because electric cars are likely to last longer. Will Apple have an upgrade program like they do now with the phone? That actually may make a lot of sense. We talked about this before, the paradox that a new car costs or a used car, just barely used, costs a huge there's a huge discount.
Sure, 40% sometimes. Yeah.
And so what Apple could do that could really change the game is they could provide a guaranteed purchase back or leasing or some sort of leasing type structure that would allow them to either take an old car and recycle it or even refurbish it and sell it again. And this then goes to the heart of the matter: is the new car that Apple introduces actually something more of a long-term classic car that doesn't get facelifted every year and doesn't have this planned obsolescence? Because planned obsolescence came into the system mainly because of the manufacturing method that people had to, GM and others had to work out how to sell cars into a market that was saturated, and so they designed the car to have a finite life, mm-hmm. And maybe Apple can go in the opposite direction, and although priced at a premium, and maybe it'll just last longer. I've always asked this question: why aren't cars built to last?
The factory must run, Horace.
Well, maybe the factory doesn't have to run anymore. That's the whole question: is can a factory be designed differently so that I don't know. There's so many things. There's so many variables that you think are constants. That's the problem. Is that the world of cars is filled with presumed constants, and they're not. They're variables. Production is a variable. Pricing is a variable.
Distribution
is a variable.
Financing,
ownership or non-ownership is a variable.
Right.
So if you come in as an entrant, you don't go read up on what the gospel is in terms of constants. You start to ask exactly what do we want to do based on what our competency is.
And maybe that's the value exciting. Proposition will be different. If you think about the buyers for this thing, or I should say the lessees, the buyers, the users of this thing have grown up with iPhones. So perhaps the experience, the interior experience, the information experience, the entertainment, whatever it is, the experience is that much richer than what has come before. I remember a controversial statement that a Cadillac marketing person said maybe a year. We talked about this a while ago, that it's not about the car, you know, and the car people were like, oh, you've got to be kidding. And she was referring to fashion, aesthetics, the experience, you know, all these things. And Tesla has certainly told us some of that, or Porsche or other brands. So maybe the basis of value or the reason people will choose this might be different than what we know today. And that could drive different distribution.
The jobs to be done, they're going to have to change.
The Winnebago, the mobile Winnebago,
We explore that as an extreme extrapolation of what would happen if you truly have autonomy. You don't hire the car to transport you, but rather as a place you live. And the same questions would arise. What would you do if you were a designer of a car that had a computer at its heart? And that becomes a completely different discussion. And that's what design is all about. Design is about being thoughtful and trying to think ahead, trying to play chess with purpose, with, you know, trying to work out what is the purpose of the product. And then when Johnny Ive says, we deeply care about a product, he's saying we deeply design a product. Caring and designing are synonyms in this world. And so thoughtfulness, caring, design is about really understanding purpose. And that's where when you take a new object, like a car, and you study its purpose, you have to be thoughtful. You have to make a design. And that's what I think they've been doing for Johnny since he was a kid. He's probably been thinking about this since he was a kid. And all designers probably take that product as an artist might paint a nude, and those sort of becomes the thing you do to master your art. So to master the art of a designer, you probably want to take one of the most complex objects, one of the most complex purposes that exists, which is either the home or the car today. That's what's so great about cars from a designer's point of view. It's like, what could you do with such a canvas on which you can lay down your thoughts? And this is why cars attract designers. This is why architecture and other things also are wonderful things to stretch your thoughts on. But the car is particularly interesting. So anyway, I'm sure that this is what motivates them.
Exactly. So in closing, I one other thing I've thought about as I ponder the history of cars, are there other jobs to be done that perhaps we have disbanded, we've given up on, we have ignored over the years that something new, an entrant, might take advantage of? If you think about the early Model Ts, they were useful for many things, from transport to a power supply and other things for farms. And so I will leave that as we close this episode, show, and think about what other jobs might be out there for a new entrant. So it's always great, Horace.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
Thanks.